Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to another Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, our weekly programme looking at all things technology related from a blind and partially sighted perspective. If you want to get in contact with us, please do. You can drop us an email or attach a voice note to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk at rnib.org.uk. Coming up this week, we'll be speaking to Activision about what happens when research into the experiences of blind and partially sighted players meets the realities of game development. We'll be hearing about how the NVDA Coach add-on can provide step-by-step instructions to help you get to grips with the NVDA screen reader. And we'll be going through a couple of your emails as well. The usual team joining me this week, Hubert Pavelkovich, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Let's see what's been catching our eyes this week. Jackie?
I've been messing around with an app that you can download onto your Windows PC. I'll give you the web address in a minute. But it's called Flashnote. And it's made by somebody called Softvoile. That's Softvoile. And it's a really useful app that you can launch anywhere when you're on your machine. If you want to take a note or a phone number, you might be in the middle of doing something and you realize you need to make a note of something, or you need to take down a number, and you can launch it anywhere. So it's a really good, useful little app that you can run on your Windows machine. The only issue that I have with it at the moment, and I think I can change the keystroke on this, is it uses Alt S to launch it. Now, every time I send an email,
I send plenty of them,
I use the Alt S command. And the same when I'm creating a calendar invitation, I use Alt S to send the invitation. So every time I do that at the moment, it brings up this flash note, and I have to then use the control and enter to send an email or whatever I'm doing that requires Alt S. So I'm trying to work out a way of changing the keystroke so that I don't need to use Alt S, because it's really annoying. And every time I send an email, up comes flash note. And I have to escape out of that and then send the email with Alt S. So it's a very useful little app. And the website to get it is https://softvoile.com/flashnote, FLASHNOTE.
I like the sound of this, because the amount of times I'm on a phone call, on a work phone call or a work meeting, and someone goes, yeah, could you just note this down? And I'm there opening Notepad, opening a new Notepad window, typing it in, saving it in my notes. I like the ability to quickly bring something up, type it out, press enter, it saves in the app. Brilliant.
And the thing with this is that you can keep your list of notes, you can access them. So it's really useful if you want to keep things that you've noted down for a later date. You can just save it, and there's your list of notes when you go back to it. So it is a really, really useful. I think it's a very low footprint. It doesn't, it's not hungry for resources. Just I need to sort out, and I think you can change the key sequence, so I'm going to try and do that. But otherwise, it's a good app.
I saw an article about this recently. I don't know if this is where you saw it from as well. It sounds like it's actually been around for a while. It's one of these little hidden gems, I think. I am going to try this out, because, like you mentioned there about using Notepad, and that's what I do all the time. I just quickly type in Notepad and then take something down, and then I save it, and I've always got no idea where it's gone. I don't know if you find this, but it just disappears when you quickly save something. If you go through like the save as dialogue or something, and then it's usually all right if you've got the time to browse to where you want to save it. But if you just do Control S, or if you just close it down, because I think Notepad kind of automatically save, well, it does, Because I've had it before as well where, and you can change this, but you open Notepad and you're in the last file that you've used. And then you've taken a note over the top of a note or in the middle of another note. And
I know.
Yes. Oh, this annoys me.
This is much more slick, you know, for something that's probably been around for a while. This is, you know, this is really quite useful.
Yeah, it does sound good. It's funny you talk about, this is a bit of an aside from Flashnote, but it's funny you talk about clashing keyboard shortcuts as well. I use Reaper for when I'm recording demos and stuff. And there's a command in there where if you're cutting something out, say you select a few seconds of audio and you're waiting to cut it, you can do Alt Space and that will play your content but without your selection. So you can hear how it sounds before you cut it out. So you can just make sure, unless you need to move your selection a little bit. And every time I did that command, Alt Space, at some point, it started bringing something else up, like search for plugins. And I'm like, oh, what's this? So I just kind of assumed, because it's Reaper and plugins and stuff, the Reaper shortcut had changed. But I couldn't see anything about it. And then I found that it was doing it all over the system. And it turned out there was another app, which I won't really get into, but there was another app that I'd installed. And for some reason, Alt Space was one of its keyboard shortcuts. But that took me a good few weeks to hunt down what that was. And I only found it by chance. But yeah, I've got my Alt Space back now, which I'm very, very happy about. Natalie, what have you got for us?
I've got a good one and a bad one. So the good news is, for anyone who remembers me moaning a few months ago that one of the recent Apple iOS updates had removed the ability for somebody using VoiceOver to be able to attach, funnily enough, an attachment to an email from within the Mail app, they had managed to hide that button from VoiceOver users. Well, it's back. So now we can add attachments. And to be fair to them, it's only taken them a couple of months, which in the scheme of things isn't too bad going. So I was very happy to see that back. On the flip side, they've also updated Maps, as in Apple Maps. And for anybody who's not familiar with Apple Maps, if you're using it to find a location, and what you do is you search it up, you select the address, and then it'll give you different options, sort of driving, walking, public transport, etc. And then within that, if there's more than one route option, it will give you those listed by time, so the shortest to the longest. And next to each one of those, it says go. So the idea is you could select the, say, this quickest one, and you'd read down the list of instructions, and maybe you're like, no, that's a lot of turns, can we get a simpler but smooth, like the slower route? You come out of that, you'd go down the list and so on and so forth, and then you'd hit go on the one that you want to use. They have removed the ability to preview those steps now, so you can see the list of times. So you can see that this option is going to take 15 minutes, this one 16, this one 18, and you can see the go buttons next to it, but you can't actually drill down into it, which has very much upset me, because I quite like to look at maps beforehand to be like, is this in the vicinity I'm already familiar with? At what point do I actually need to get out my phone and start checking? You know, am I good up until this point? And I can't do that now. I did try looking at Google Maps, because I know a lot of people like to use Google Maps, and I still can't make head nor tail of it. It gave me lots of information about reviews and what the location was good for, but could I get directions? No. So I ended up going back to Apple Maps and just hitting go and hoping for the best. And it worked out fine, but it has frustrated me somewhat.
Google Maps is a weird one. I feel like there's too much going on in terms of, like you said, yeah. I mean, one thing that I found is that search field. Sometimes it's at the top, sometimes it isn't. It just vanishes. Mm-hmm. Don't know if anyone else has seen that. I don't want to know, like, the one that really annoys me is photos, because the first thing that it seems to land on with me when I double tap a location is the photos that people have shared, I guess, of that location or in that location. I don't really know, but I just get stuck in a long list of photos.
Yeah, photos are a pain, because you only need one user to upload 10 and then you're stuck.
You just can't get away from
it. I found, Google Maps had all these different tabs, but none of them were directions. And I thought, this is so useless. If I wanted reviews, I would have gone into TripAdvisor.
The best way that I've found to do it is through Siri. So, like, if you say to Siri, navigate okay. to, like, get directions to this place using Google Maps, it will pull it up in Maps, and I think, well, in Google Maps, I should say, and I think that takes you straight to the directions screen.
Oh, I'll try that next time. Thanks for that, Calvin.
Yeah, give that a go. It is a little bit annoying, though, if you're in Google Maps already and you've looked for a place manually to check where it is, and then you've got to use Siri instead of clicking a button.
Yeah.
But that does work, so maybe give that a go. Because one thing I like about Google Maps, if you go into the settings, I can't remember exactly where it is, but I think it's settings and then I think it's voice or it's walking directions or something. But if you scroll right down, there's detailed voice guidance, and then that'll give you a bit more info rather than just like turn left. It will say like turn left onto this street and then continue straight for 100 yards. And then as you're walking, it'll be like it's 50 yards to your next turn. It's 30 yards to your next turn. Just give you those extra little hints.
That's quite good, because I do sometimes find that with Apple Maps. Siri does a similar thing, but if I've used VoiceOver to check something at the same time, the two voices sometimes clash, and then I get no information, which is very frustrating.
Just a quick one from me this week. We've been talking for a while about the apps that are coming to the Meta glasses. They're slowly but surely making their way out there. Ira mentioned, I think it was last month, they mentioned they've got a deeper integration coming, and that is now available. So if you go into the Ira, they've done it very similar to Orion, actually, which we spoke about last week. So if you go into the app, the Ira app, while you've got your glasses on, and then go to the More tab on Ira, and then there's an option there to connect Meta AI glasses. You go in there, you give it the permissions for camera and microphone, all that, and there you go, it's connected. And then if you're wearing your glasses when you start an Ira call, then it will use your glasses camera. If you're not, then it will use your phone's camera. So they've been able to do this for a while, because I've seen a few people say this. Well, weren't they already on the glasses? They were, but it was a bit of a clunky... They were using a workaround using WhatsApp. So you would call the Ira agent, they would then message you a link, which sometimes you had to click on. Sometimes it would automatically just throw you into the WhatsApp call. Then you had to join the WhatsApp call, and then you could switch to the glasses. It was a little bit fiddly. And if you're like me, where you're on the 5 minutes free plan, then it kind of ate into your time a little bit. If it worked, then it was like 30 seconds. But if it didn't, if something happened, then you could waste a good 2 minutes trying to just get it to connect up. So I haven't tried this. It's only come available recently, but from what I hear, it's working really well. Well, a lot to get into this week. Some very interesting stuff, as always. Stick with us. This is Tech Talk. You're listening to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, and today we're talking about inclusive game design, and specifically what happens when research into the experiences of blind and partially sighted players meets the realities of game development. This conversation builds on a recent collaboration between RNIB and Activision, including research into the social impact of video games for players with sight loss, as well as public discussion around accessibility and comfort features in game design. The big theme today is that accessibility isn't just about removing barriers. It's also about connection, belonging, and creating better experiences for more players. We have a few guests joining us to help us dig into some of the research and some of these findings. So from RNIB, we have Sonali, who is the Media Culture and Immersive Technologies Manager. And we also have Johnny, who is RNIB's Operational Research Officer. And from Activision, we have Adrian, the Director of Inclusive Game Design, Magali, the Lead UX Designer, Eva, who is a Senior UX Designer, and Vicky, a User Researcher. Guys, thanks so much, all of you, for joining us. Adrian, if I come to you first, tell us how this research came about. What led Activision to pursue this study?
Well, thank you so much for having us on this show. I want to start off a bit that Activision makes games, in case people aren't familiar. We develop and publish franchises like the Call of Duty franchises, Tony Hawk Pro Skaters, Spyro the Dragon, Crash Bandicoot, and much more. Gaming is a massive global industry at the intersection of entertainment and interactivity, and it influences everything from technology, culture, and how people connect and play. And we fundamentally think that gaming should invite everyone to play. And we want our games to be enjoyed by the widest audience possible. And across Activision, accessibility has become a priority because access to these games means more people can participate and play in ways that work for them. Our teams have explored innovations across different features, from asymmetric hearing compensation, movement options that reduce input complexity, and more that we'll hear later on. And video games inherently rely very much on visual information. So sight loss is an especially important area to understand better. We were interested not just in the mechanics of play, but also in how blind and partially sighted players experience games socially, how they adapt, and where design can do more to support them. So research in this space has shown that there's still a meaningful gap in accessibility for blind and partially sighted players, which makes continued learning and co-creation especially important. So at Activision, we commissioned the research to sharpen our understanding of players with sight loss. The goal is not accessibility as a checklist. I don't think it's ever been. It is to build more innovation, more inclusive experiences that reflect how people actually play. And for working with the RNIB, that was the goal. And we're excited to be able to speak on that today.
Yeah, and that's a good place to bring RNIB in, actually, because the research has shown that 95% of gamers with sight loss play video games, with many of them playing daily. What does that tell us about players with sight loss and the relation to gaming?
So what this really tells us is that we have a really engaged audience. We're not talking about a niche audience or an occasional audience. When 95% of respondents are playing and many are doing so daily, it challenges some of the assumptions, you know, about who gaming is really for. What we're seeing is that blind and partially sighted players are, they're deeply invested in gaming as an activity, as a medium. So the interest is there, the demand is there. And in many cases, people are just finding workarounds, navigating around barriers just to stay engaged, just to be able to play. So the opportunity is, it's not about creating new audiences. It's really to better support an audience that already exists.
In the study, some of the players with sight loss have described gaming as bringing a sense of connection and belonging. You know, one participant has shared experiences of playing with their sister who lives far away, or even just playing with friends across the UK.
It shows that gaming is doing something much deeper than just entertainment. For many players, it's a way of staying connected with friends, family, and having shared experiences, which is particularly important for blind and partially sighted when other forms of engagement might be more limited.
And Adrian, just coming back to you, when you hear that and when you have that data, how does that shape the way that you guys at Activision think about accessibility?
I think it reinforces so much of what we believe in the good of gaming, that gaming is not just a pastime, it's actually a part of social connection, a play of reconnecting with friends and family. So gaming as a component to human play is something that is so key.
And Johnny, the research has also showed that blind and partially sighted players are very highly engaged with gaming and often playing daily and for long sessions. Did that surprise you? Did anything surprise you about that data? And yeah, what does it tell us about the importance, I guess, of the accessibility in design?
I think what stood out most here was the tension between engagement and some of the frictions caused by accessibility barriers. So you have players who are spending a long time playing, and they're spending hours and hours in game modes, and they're really committed to the game, but they're facing many challenges and many accessibility barriers. And they say it's kind of shaping their experience of gaming. And it's really important in determining how immersed somebody becomes in the game. So the bigger the barriers that there are can create more cognitive load on people, and that can reduce the level of immersion.
And Vicky, you work quite closely with the designers and the developers in your role. What are some of the misconceptions that designers have about blind and partially sighted players?
One common misconception is that blind and partially sighted players are a single group with one set of needs. But in reality, sight loss exists on a wide spectrum, and different players rely on very different combinations of contrast, scaling, audio cues, layout clarity, and control predictability. So designing well starts with understanding that variation instead of assuming one feature solves everything. And of course, to validate solutions across different player profiles through research. And another misconception is that visual accessibility is only about seeing more. Often it is about presenting information differently and more clearly. For example, through audio structure, timing, contrast, and customization. That's why the strongest solutions tend to be systems that offer multiple channels of information, not just the bigger UI. That's something we consistently see in usability testing. That principle is visible in public examples like Black Ops 6 high contrast customization.
And Magali and Eva, if I can just turn to you guys for a couple of minutes, what are some of the examples of the accessibility features within Activision games?
In Call of Duty, we've developed a range of accessibility features, from high contrast mode and asymmetrical hearing compensation to intelligent movement and support for adaptive controller. What's important for us is that these aren't isolated features. They come from a consistent approach where we identify barriers early and design solutions that can scale across the experience.
So, how do the team at Activision approach designing and developing for accessibility?
At Activision, we have a large amount of teams and studios that are developing the games. That's just a fact. But additional ones is that many of our developers are interested and keen on inclusivity and how to make sure that the game can be reflective of the needs of a variety of more players. That means that on top of the different gameplay innovations and new features that are happening, we also have many people like those who are joining today who are keenly interested in accessibility. So what we do is develop plans and opportunities to explore these features, see how it can fit with the current game and schedule, understand what is their impact on our players and users, and develop them so that they don't just exist, but they're refined, that they're polished and they're effective.
Johnny and Sonali, just from the RNIB side, we obviously the big focus of the report was the features that blind and partially sighted gamers value the most. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those insights?
What was really interesting was that the most valued features were often also quite foundational. So things like audio cues, text to speech, clear navigation, and strong customization options, they all came through very strongly. So these were what allowed players to independently understand and move through the game. In addition to these, what we also saw were things like tutorials, onboarding matter. They just matter as much as all the other features. So accessibility wasn't just about individual features, it was about the whole experience, how it's structured and how it's communicated.
So let's turn to comfort and motion sickness features, which is also a big part of the research. Eva and Magali, just going back to you guys, why was motion sickness an important area for the team to explore, and what's the relation with that to accessibility?
So motion sickness really matters because it can be the difference between a player enjoying the game and having to stop playing altogether. It's also important because motion sensitivity is a real and broad barrier and not an edge case at all. An estimated one-third of the population is susceptible to motion sickness in some way. So exploring motion reduction is consistent with our goal of helping more people play comfortably and confidently.
Something that I found interesting, motion sickness as being different need, same process. Why is that an important lens when looking at accessibility?
That lens is useful because it keeps teams focused on removing barriers, not labels. Whether it's low vision, hearing loss, dexterity, cognitive load, or motion sensitivity, the process stays the same. We identify friction, learn from players who experience it, we prototype, we test in real play, and we build flexible features that preserve the core experience. That's why we focus on co-creation, iteration, and building system, not one-off fixes. It also helps us avoiding ranking needs against each others. Motion sickness might not always be discussed alongside more familiar categories, but if it stops someone from playing, it's a real access issue. And this approach helps us build stronger and more resilient systems overall.
And Johnny, do you feel like that resonates with the research findings?
Yeah, I think it does resonate with the research findings. It's kind of finding features that make people be able to engage for longer. And if that's kind of a simple thing or a more complicated thing, as long as it's kind of improving the comfort of everyone playing. And I think that kind of came out in our research, which talked about sort of the importance of feeling included as part of the community. And it's kind of an area where gamers get quite excited about being part of it. And if something is designed in an inclusive way, it allows people to be involved in the same experience. So I think it does all tie together nicely.
Yeah. What would you say is the difference between creating accessible options and designing accessible systems?
That's a good question. This is really more about philosophy. We talk about accessibility as something that's by design, meaning it's considered from the start, not layered on top. It's about building something that lasts across titles and over time, so we can consistently reduce barriers and build better player experiences.
This one is particularly an interesting conversation with people who do work on accessibility and inclusive design. Adding options is always important, but it can still leave accessibility feeling bolted on. Building accessible systems instead means that we're considering access at the level of the core experience. Things like how information is communicated, how actions are performed, how menus are structured, contrast and readability, even things like how sound can carry gameplay information. All of those things that players can be able to tune their own experiences. So for our perspectives and work, accessibility is really a core part of the game design and experience. It's not just a menu of exceptions.
I've spoken quite a bit about some of the accessibility features. We were talking about that earlier. Have there been any surprises since those features shipped, or like surprising findings? I imagine there's been quite a few.
What's really great to see, but not surprising, is how broadly accessibility features are used. While about a quarter of the world's population identifies as having a disability, in our games, we see that nearly half of players engage with accessibility settings.
And to add on a little bit more data to that, we've also observed that more than half of our players adjust settings related to graphics and accessibility, like camera movement, motion blur, and field of view. And additionally, roughly 40% of all players use a feature called intelligent movement, which simplifies in-game navigation so you don't have to press quite as many buttons to do some complex actions. Seeing how popular accessibility is, not just how important it is, to so many players reinforces that belief. So agree with Magali. I'm not sure I'm surprised, but it's a pleasant kind of reinforcing surprise of seeing the importance of accessibility in game design.
I would say that these are really powerful reminders that these accessibility features are not only for a small subset of users. They help a wide range of players customize comfort, clarity, and control.
Also, we see accessible design often improves the experience beyond the original use case. Features built for a specific barrier can also help players in noisy environments, using different input devices, managing fatigue, or simply wanting more control.
One of the big themes of this research was the role that gaming plays in connection and belonging. Johnny, why do you think this is so important for blind and partially sighted players?
Because for many players, gaming is a very exciting space. They can participate in a kind of equal landscape, and it's kind of a shared experience, so it kind of creates a real sense of being included. And I think the kind of community comes from kind of two angles. There's kind of more of a social community, but I think the research also kind of highlighted the community of being included by designers and having accessibility included. And I think when that all comes together, it creates a very nice shared environment where gamers can enjoy things on more of a level playing field. But it's kind of a coalition of when everything comes together, it can create a really healthy community.
And Adrian, from your perspective at Activision, Why is accessibility a priority at Activision? But I guess that answer kind of covers it in some ways, I would assume.
Yes. Aside from the passion and interest that we have on accessibility, the aspect of accessibility and design is a priority for us because great games should invite more people in, not leave people out. And when we remove barriers, we just make our games better. The games are more flexible and overall more welcoming for the communities who play them.
I totally agree. And I just want to add on that I do strongly feel that video games should be accessible by default as much as possible. You start up the game and play, and hopefully that could cover a wide range of players from the start.
Just to try and wrap all this up a little bit and summarize some of this then, Vicky, I feel like I'm going to throw a really tough one out to you here, but we'll try anyway. If there's one thing that game developers should take away from all of these findings, what would you say it should be?
Well, the takeaway would be, do not design for assumptions. Design with players. There is still a knowledge gap in the industry around accessibility. So for more inclusive, accessible design, direct research and testing are very important, especially by combining behavioral, subjective, and physiological data. And second, accessibility is not separate from good design. The more clearly a game communicates, the more control it gives players, the more channels it offers for receiving information, and of course, the stronger the experience becomes for everyone.
And Sonali, same question to you, I guess. What would you say developers should take away from this?
I think you're right. It is a big question. I completely agree with what Vicky has just said. So accessibility, you know, it really directly shapes how long and how someone can really participate in gaming. So the players are already there, the engagement is already there. It's the opportunity to design in a way that reduces friction, allows that level of engagement, you know, to grow. So the takeaway is really about seeing accessibility not as a constraint, but as an opportunity, as a way to create better and more accessible experiences for more players.
I think really, overall, this research just shows that it's not just about reducing barriers. It's about making games overall just more playable, more comfortable, more enjoyable for blind and partially sighted players, but for everyone as well. Some fantastic research. And I think what's great as well is that when research and design are working closely, those features, that work gets stronger and those features just get better for everyone. So some very interesting research, very interesting findings. And thanks to all of you, the teams at RNIP and Activision, for joining us to discuss this. It's been a great conversation. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to RNIB Connect Radio, and it's time to discuss NVDA, the free screen reader that we haven't discussed too much on Tech Talk, but recently I have seen a development with the screen reader which I thought is good to bring to people's attention, especially those people who are new to NVDA and would like to learn the screen reader in a bit of an easier way. An add-on has been created which you can install alongside the screen reader in order to learn how to use it. But what exactly is it and how does it work? Well, I'm joined by Tony Gebhard, who created said add-on. Tony, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Huber. Appreciate that. Glad to be here and to shine a positive light for NVDA users and hang out a little bit.
So before we actually talk about the add-on, let's talk about NVDA. For those who may not know what NVDA is, can you give us a little bit of a summary as to what it is?
NVDA is a free open source screen reader that was created by NV Access in 2006. Their mission is to bring accessibility tools to everyone, free of cost around the world.
And how long have you been using NVDA for?
I've been using NVDA for 11 years, more than that, actually. Lord, I'd say 2009 was the first time I picked up NVDA, and it was still in its infancy.
How do you find using it now?
It's the default for me, even at work. It's the default screen reader I use for work, at home, for all my projects, everything. It stands up today.
So let's talk about this. Let's talk about add-ons then. Talk about your add-on specifically, what is an NVDA add-on and how do they tend to work?
I mentioned earlier that NVDA is an open source screen reader. So the word open source essentially just means it's the programming the code in this program is free access for everyone. So essentially an add-on, a developer or someone can go and take the code and say, I want to make something that helps make this program better. And that's essentially what an add-on is. It's an extension of the screen reader, a feature, something that adds an enhancement to the software. And in this case, it could be training, it could be making another program more accessible. It's a pretty wide frame thing in that regard. But that's kind of really, to put it simply, what an add-on does is it makes the user experience more enhanced, and anything from accessibility to something fun, productivity, anything you can think of.
Now, NVDA itself is a free screen reader. What about add-ons? Are they free? Are they paid for? Or is that a kind of a mixed bag?
A majority of them are free. I mean, I've never seen a developer sell an add-on per se. That they'll definitely put the donations offer out there for anyone who wants to help contribute to their work. But 99.99% of the time, they're all free, and you can access the add-on directory via the add-on store, which is built into the tools menu of NVDA.
Now let's move on to the add-on you have created. So you've created the NVDA Coach add-on. I'll ask you how it works in a minute, but first, you know, how did the idea come about for you? What inspired it?
Sure. So I'm going to throw a big disclaimer out there and say that this is all developed by Claude, many, many months of my own testing and trial and error of learning code and learning how to implement Python. And I'm sort of one of those newer pseudo vibe coders, if you will, adding some controversy to this. But what inspired it was there's always been a big push for training in a lot of these spaces. And NVDA as a screen reader has a great user guide, super robust, pretty easy to navigate. But what NVDA has never really had was either a built-in feature or an add-on that provides a sandbox for anyone who is new to NVDA to be able to learn how to use the program efficiently, or a new screen reader user, if you will. And as a teacher of 7 years who's been in this field, that's my biggest dream, is to give people easier access to those tools so that, one, they can have a sandbox to play in practice, but two, you know, be able to have spoken prompts, be able to have feedback or helpful tips along the way without having to painstakingly read through a very robust and long user guide.
And, you know, sandbox is always a great environment. But for those who don't know what a sandbox might be, can you tell us what that is?
A sandbox, you know, it essentially is a safe and secure environment for you to test out. I'll give an example, a login page on, let's say, your bank's website. We can create a sandbox environment of that where it almost looks just like it, except anything that you type into it, anything that you trigger on the page, such as a login button, a sign-in button, a remember me checkbox that you might see on a page, they won't do anything. They're dummies, essentially. It's a dummy page, but it's a safe sandbox environment where you can actually have real-world navigation experience so that you can apply it to when you are going on online.
So quite a nice practice environment there, definitely. So this NVDA Coach add-on, can you tell us how it works once it has been installed?
So I wanted to make it as easy as possible. Once it's installed, you press the NVDA key, shift key, and the letter C, as in Charlie, and it brings up the NVDA Coach menu. Now, in this menu, you'll have 7 options to choose from. And at the top, it starts with the introduction. So you can hit enter on that to read the introduction. And it pulls you into a multi-line edit box that tells you about the add-on, a couple of tips along the way. And then if you go back to the menu once again, you'll find the chapters that will take you through this. And as of right now, there are 34 lessons inside of MVDA Coach, and it is expanding as feedback floods in from the community. And I want to just give a thank you on the side note to some of the initial folks that have been assisting in the feedback process. You navigate through each of these individual chapters, getting started, reading and moving through text, browse mode and web navigation, object navigation, which is a feature in NVDA that you can explore later, customizing NVDA, and additional training and help, which is not a required chapter. It's just that's where you can find the link to the code itself for the NVDA add-on, NVAccess's website, along with the user guide and the practice page sandbox environment if you wanted to use that further in later practice.
And the guide itself, all the lessons, you know, have you written them yourself or did you use already existing materials to try and combine the two? How have you created the chapters itself, the lessons?
This is where I kind of used a mixture of my expertise and experience as a human instructor and the assistance of Claude, Anthropic Claude, to help me kind of organize this in a code form. So I wanted to use the get started function because I like to think about what is the end user thinking? What do they need to hear? What is the most important? And sometimes robust instruction is sometimes the best instead of assuming. That's kind of the thing that I've learned. So I went through and I wrote down probably 15 to 20 different lesson structures myself in lesson planning, how I would write a lesson plan. And I took all this information plus a couple of bits from the user guide that I thought would be essential. And that's where I began the planning phase months ago with Anthropic's Claude to try and say, how can we turn this into something that is usable and something that is going to genuinely assist and help somebody in the field, especially when they're getting started.
You've mentioned Anthropic's Claude. Now, we've mentioned a few kind of AI things before, but can you tell us briefly what that is?
Anthropic's Claude. Anthropic is a company that creates and distributes AI products. Claude is what's known as a large language model, as is ChatGPT and Google Gemini. And if you get onto a paid tier with one of these particular large language models, you'll have access to more robust tools. I feel like I've been saying that word a lot, robust. That seems to be the the featured word of the day. It has built-in tools such as code analysis. It can create documents for you based on information that you give it. But a lot of it comes down to what you prompt it to do. You know, there is a duality here in opinion in the industry. You know, people think prompt engineering, you know, is it real? Is it not? And, you know, I'm kind of on the side where yeah, absolutely it is. You know, what we feed the AI information and how it interprets it. And of course, you know, going back and being able to reference the work and make sure that it's doing exactly what you want. So again, rigorous work, but sort of long story short, it's a large language model.
Have you got plans to create any future add-ons for NVDA?
Well, I mean, we'll see. You know, we'll absolutely see. You know, this is my first NVDA add-on. Generally, I'm more of a musician and like to do small coding projects on the side. But this was my first real step up to make something effective for people learning and needing tools. So, you know, the world is quite an oyster, and I'm hoping that yes, absolutely, there's room to grow here, both in a macro environment with NVDA and also just a professional journey. So yeah, I'm hoping so.
Fantastic. And before we finish, if people would like to get hold of this NVDA Coach add-on and, you know, experience it themselves, how can they get one of these?
Absolutely. So as of right now, we're still waiting for add-on store approval. It's in review right now. So normally I would say go to your NVDA add-on store inside of NVDA. However, right now, you can find it at my website or my GitHub link, which I can provide here, github.com/TONYGEB23/NVDA coach-. That will take you directly to the add-on itself, as well as my website, tonygebhard.me/NVDA coach, where I have all the information about the add-on.
Fantastic. And if people would like to contact you to give you, you know, any feedback, how can they do that?
Absolutely. And I welcome it more than anything else. The community, you know, and let me just add a quick note. You know, the great thing about NVDA is it's community driven. So, you know, if we don't listen to what the community wants, what the community needs, there's going to be no growth. So I please welcome it. It's info@tonygebhard.me and TONYGEBHARD.ME. So info@tonygebhard.me. If you try the add-on, please tell me what you think, good and bad and the ugly. I want to make it as perfect as it can be for new students and new users of this extension.
Sounds like you've got definitely a great passion for technology and technology training too, which from someone who, you know, dabbled in that before for many years, it's quite interesting to hear. So we'll probably hear from you on Tech Talk again. But for now, Tony Gebhard, thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Tech Talk.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Let's get into some of the emails then. We've had a message come in from Rod, who says, "Hi team, one of the many disappointments with iOS 26, many disappointments, one of the many disappointments with iOS 26 was the ability to no longer see the battery level of Bluetooth connected devices via the control center. To compensate for this, I installed the battery widget at the top of my home screen, and now I have battery information available at all times. And if anyone else would benefit from this, it is really simple to achieve." That's a good tip, that. I know, Hubert, you were saying quite a while ago you'd got into the widgets.
I love this widget. It's really good, and I use it all the time. I do find with third-party devices, the battery indicator sometimes doesn't always keep up straight away. So sometimes you might get a bit of a kind of lag on that. But in general, I really like that widget myself. I think there are third-party apps that might do this better. I would like to see, like, my iPad battery as well, rather than just my phone and my watch, for example, and a peripheral connected such as the glasses. But yeah, I think the widget is definitely very useful for that one.
The only way I know to do that, to check on other devices, because your phone, your Apple Watch, for me, the phone, the Apple Watch, and the AirPods come up, as well as my AirPods case. And the only way I've found to check other devices apart from that, they're in your iCloud account, is through the Find My app, which is a really clunky way of doing it.
Yeah, and it's a clunky app anyway, that, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
What I found with mine as well is that it was always in the, I think it's called the Today view. I don't know if that's there for everyone or if I've put it there at some point and then forgotten, which is possible. But for me, if you go to the first page of your home screen and then do a three-finger flick right, you'll get a search field, and then there's a bunch of widgets in there as well if you swipe right from that. So if you don't want it cluttering your home screen, then it might be in there as well. But yeah, that's a good tip. It's a really useful little widget, is that, along with a bunch of others. If you go into the widgets section of the home screen, there's a whole lot of things that you can add there. So yeah, cheers for that, Rod. I hope that helps you if you're struggling with that. We've also had a message from Kelly, who seems very happy with the Orion app. She says, "Hi team, I'm so glad you mentioned the Orion app. I use it a lot. When travelling on the train, I use it for finding my suitcase, as it does a brilliant job of describing where it is." She says she also uses it for reading the labels on tins, because it describes really well in terms of where to point your head and which direction to look in. She says, "The only downfall is I wish it used a more natural voice. as the voice it uses is quite robotic. There might be a way to fix that. So if you go into settings in the Orion app, if you go into settings and then parameters, if you scroll down, I think it's quite far down the list, but there is an option to use VoiceOver as assistant voice. And if you turn that on, that will use your VoiceOver voice and settings. So it'll push the announcements through VoiceOver rather than through the system voice.
Yeah, that's a good tip. I've got a friend who started using that Orion as well. And he said the only thing is that when he goes out and about with the glasses on, it doesn't stop chuntering. It just tells him everything that he's passing, literally. And it could be, you know, just some stuff that he doesn't really need to know. Tells you people walking towards you, what they're wearing and everything. So I don't know if you can customize it. I haven't played with it too much, but that's one of the comments I've heard.
I have found that, I must admit. I think I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that I'd prefer to sort of be able to customize sort of how much it speaks. I think it's one of the cases of just getting your prompt right. You know, when you ask it what you want. Like, I was posting something the other day and I was trying to locate, because there's a post box near me, but it's quite sort of, you know, one of these ones that's quite hidden away. So it's like just next to a road crossing, but you've got to sort of indent and go quite far to the right, and then eventually you'll find it. But it's kind of a tricky one to find, but I know it's there. So normally I have to kind of wander around and find it, and usually I'll walk past it and then walk back and try and, like, you know, cane in one hand and
so, yeah,
holding your hand up in front of you. So I used Orion to, I just said search for a post box because that's one of the objects that's in his list. So I fired that up, and for ages it was just saying, I don't see a post box in front of you. You may need to adjust the camera. I don't see a post box in front of you. I don't see a post box in the current view. I still don't see a post box in front of you. Yeah, all right. Just, I know I'm not there yet. Yeah. Just tell me when you do see it. I think they are working on that, though. I think they are working on more customization options there.
I think Scribe Me had the same issue. They are doing what they're supposed to on paper, where they will tell you what it is in front of you, but they'll take it literally and they will literally tell you everything that's in front of you.
Yeah, that's right.
It is a good app, though, and as we keep saying, they're all work in progress, especially when it comes to the glasses. Because the thing that they're using, the software development kit from Meta, is in beta. So, in other words, the kit itself that allows them to use the glasses is in beta, never mind the apps themselves. So they are pretty limited in what they can work with. But it is good. And of course, we'll keep you up to date, because I'm sure more customization is going to come to that. But yeah, very happy Orion user there. Thanks for that, Kelly. And if you've got anything you want to share with us, get in touch. techtalk@rnib.org.uk.
Time to browse through some of the products that are currently available in the RNIB online shop here on RNIB Connect Radio. And Charlie Jarvis, RNIB Shop's buying administrator, joins me now to walk me through some of the items that are currently on display, including a fantastic new range of products that have just been added to this shop too. Hello, Charlie. How are you?
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
So firstly, Charlie, do give me a bit of an overview of the RNIB online shop and a flavour of some of the items that people can buy, as products range from white canes to electronic magnifiers, and from braille paper and braille displays to bump-ons, to name just a few.
Yes, so the RNIB shop is a fantastic place to go for all of your low vision needs. So we categorise into education and braille, which has all of your shared reading titles and braille courses. We've got books and stationery, which is your large print and braille diaries and calendars. We've got paper and writing guides, pens and pencils, tactile stationery for schools. There's also canes, walking sticks and eyewear, which is your eye shields. We've got symbol canes, long canes and guide canes, as well as children's canes as well. And then into home and leisure, we've got lots of products in making your kitchen and bathroom accessible. There's also sports and activities, so accessible footballs, goal balls, that sort of thing. And then also toys, games and puzzles. So you've got colouring books, card games, board games like Scrabble, all of that sort of thing. And then finally going into technology, there's a range of optical and electronic magnifiers, software for your computer, so things like JAWS and Zoom Text as an example, and then accessible devices as well. So things like our talking book players on USB, wearable technology such as the Orcam, and then a range of accessible phones and tablets and smartwatches as well. So it's something for everybody.
Wow, what an incredible range. And there is a new range of products that have just been added to the R&IB online shop from Icon, including kitchen scales, a tape measure and thermometers. So, Charlie, do take me through this new range of products from Icon.
Absolutely. So I'm actually really excited about this one. Being visually impaired myself, I'm definitely going to be making a few purchases here. But essentially, it's a fully accessible range of household items. The list of products includes the controller, the tape measure, a kitchen scale, bathroom scale, kitchen thermometer, and then an indoor temperature thermometer as well. So essentially, each product is accessible for those with low vision because it has a large print digital display. But then also, if you pair the product with the controller or the app, it becomes fully talking. So even if you have no vision at all, you can still use these devices around your home. So the app itself is compatible with Android and Apple, and it's fully live at the moment and free to download. So essentially, if you didn't want to use the controller, you could purchase any of the individual devices, and then the app is free. So once you've made that initial purchase, there's no additional cost involved.
That sounds fantastic, because obviously with these items, if you've got some vision, you can see the large displays that they have. For example, on the tape measure, there's a large digital display. But obviously, if like me, you haven't got particularly good vision and rely on speech, obviously you will need either the controller or the free app. So tell me a little bit about the controller, because the controller does a little bit more than just making all the items talk.
Yes, so essentially each product will connect to the controller via Bluetooth. It's got large tactile buttons and is talking. So you'll pair the item that you've brought to the controller, and it essentially just has a speaker on it. So it will read to you any measurements. So say, for example, you've taken your tape measure out shopping with you and you want to check your waist measurements before you buy a pair of jeans, as an example. If you wanted it to talk to you, you pair them together, you press a button and it will read the measurement. Or alternatively, if you wanted to be more discreet and you didn't want to have that read out loud, you've got the digital display as a backup. So the controller is more for people who maybe don't have a smartphone or a tablet and sort of prefer the more analog way of doing things, shall we say. Whereas the app, you know, if you are quite savvy with your technology and you didn't want to have that additional purchase, then you can download the app instead.
And is there anything else on the controller as well as just being able to connect to the products and read out what the products are telling people?
So that connection there is predominantly what the controller is for. It is just to make these devices talking. So if you didn't want them talking, you don't need it. And if you did want them talking and didn't want to purchase it, then you've got the app as an alternative.
So, Charlie, what's the price of this new Icon range of products then?
So the products vary. So I'll run down the list with you now. All of these are available with VAT exemption for those who are eligible for it. So the controller itself will be £195. The tape measure is £69. The kitchen scale is also £69. Then we have the bathroom scale, which is £59. The kitchen thermometer is £39. And then the indoor thermometer will be £39 as well.
And obviously, the app is completely free. So if you are a bit more sort of tech savvy, then you can have the app and you don't necessarily need to buy the controller.
Yes, yeah, that's correct.
Well, to find out more about the Icon range of products which have just been added to the RNIB online shop and many other products too, do go to shop.rnib.org.uk/connect. Well, thank you so much indeed, Charlie, for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and telling me more about the new Icon range of products that are now available in the RNIB online shop.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
And that is all we've got time for this week. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. If you've got any thoughts or comments or questions, anything you want to share with us, any tips, let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk is that email address. You can send a written message or a voice note, and we will get your comment or your voice on air if you want us to. We'll be back with you same time, same place next week. But from me, Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovich, Jackie Brown and Natalie Curran. Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.